The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin period, French actions in the spring of 1378. Well, we dealt with what the English were planning to do. Now we're going to see the French going into action. In late April, while the Earl of Arundel was still waiting with his ships in the Thames, groups of adventurers began to put out to sea to pursue their own private enterprises. The London merchant John Philpot took some ships and about 1,000 seamen and soldiers north and captured Mercer at sea together with several Castilian merchant ships of his squadron. The Bayonne squadron, which was probably now being employed to escort Gaunt's supply ships to Brest, broke off to prey on Castilian merchant convoys entering the channel. The seamen of the Cinque-Ports carried out a series of hit-and-run raids around Fécamp on the coast of Normandy. One of them even succeeded in recovering the bells of Rye Church, carried off by the French the year before. While the English plans hung fire, a major political crisis developed in France. The end of March 1378, the French government uncovered the whole of Charles of Navarre's plans for joint operations with the English in Normandy. This appears to have happened because some ham-fisted diplomacy by English agents in southern France. In February, Sir John Roche was in Béarn trying to involve Gaston Count of Foix in the Anglo-Navarrese scheme. He seems to have upset his host by threatening reprisals if he failed to cooperate. As a result, Gaston sent a confidential message to the French king appealing for protection and disclosing the King of Navarre's horrible and detestable plot against the crown. He also told him that he thought that Jacques Leroux, then traveling through France, was part of it. Charles V knew by now about the armies gathering in southern England. When he received Gaston's message in the first week of March, he assumed they were intended for Normandy. This sealed Charles of Navarre's fate. Charles V immediately ordered the French garrisons in winter quarters east of Bordeaux to prepare to go to the Count of Foix's assistance if he was attacked. The fleet of galleys and oared barges based at the arsenal of Rouen was told to put to sea as soon as it could be made ready. Commissioners were sent to ensure that all the royal fortresses in Normandy were provisioned and garrisoned against an invasion. Meanwhile, the royal bailiffs were instructed to scour the roads for Jacques Leroux and his party. Within a few days, they were found at an inn in Namur, south of Paris, and arrested. In their baggage, the king's officers found a roll containing copies of draft treaties and correspondence, which disclosed much of Charles of Navarre's recent dealings with the English government. Jacques himself was taken first to the castle of Corbeil on the Seine, and then the Châtelet prison in Paris. Here, in a succession of confessions, he admitted the plot to poison Charles V. He revealed a plan to put English garrisons in the Navarrese castles in Normandy, and described with a wealth of circumstantial detail the story of his master's negotiations with the English going back to 1369, much of which the French king and his counselors were now learning for just the first time. At the end of March 1378, Charles V summoned Charles the Younger before him. The scene was the old 12th century palace of Louis VI at Senlis, north of Paris, whose ruins can still be seen rising above the ramparts of the town. The young Prince of Navarre appeared under the protection of a safe conduct. He was accompanied by the Bishop of Dax, a learned Norman cleric who had traveled with him from Navarre, and by Navarre's military governor of Normandy, Fernando de Enns, and by several of his father's officials and captains in France. The Navarrese prince came ready to complain about the arrest of Jacques Leroux, but he was abruptly reduced to silence by the king's counselors. One of them produced a document recording Jacques' confession. He took the prince through the history of his father's plots, all of which appear to have been new to him. The King of France said he decided to take over the 7 principal Navarrese fortresses in Normandy, including Cherbourg and Avranche, and to install his own garrisons in order to prevent them from falling into the hands of the English. The Duke of Burgundy had already been appointed to receive their surrender. All those present in his entourage would have to swear to open their gates when they were summoned to do so. The captains of the remaining Navarrese garrisons would be left in possession, but only if they swore not to admit the King of Navarre or the enemies of the realm or to make war against France. Charles the Younger and his companions, evidently seriously taken aback, swore the oath demanded on them on a copy of the Gospels and a fragment of the True Cross, the holiest relic that could be found. Most of the young prince's attendants were then released to tell garrison commanders what to do, but the prince himself and Fernando de Enns were held in Senlis to accompany the Duke of Burgundy in the Normandy. Charles was a willing guest. He was obviously shocked by the contents of Jacques Leroux's confession, and over the following months he threw in his lot in with his uncle. He was handsomely rewarded for his loyalty with an income, a retinue, and a mansion in Paris. Fernando Diaz was a different quantity. He had been the principal Navarrese captain in France during the civil wars of the 1350s and was known to be close to the English. Indeed, he had once briefly been a mercenary in their service. He was arrested as soon as he had sworn his oath and accompanied the French army as a prisoner. The preemptive strike against the Navarrese castles in Normandy had been improvised at very short notice and did take some time to gather pace. Philip of Burgundy had to send to Dijon for his own body armor and to borrow horses from the king's stable. Initially, he had no more than a few hundred men and a modest artillery train. He opened his campaign on April the 12th, 1378, at Breteuil, some 20 miles south of Évreux. Breteuil was the strongest of the group of Navarrese fortresses in eastern Normandy. The King of Navarre's second son, Pierre, had taken refuge there with most of the officers of the King of Navarre's French domains. Two other detachments of Philip's army laid siege on the same day to the Navarrese headquarters at Évreux and the fortress of Beaumont-le-Roger. On April the 14th, it was the turn of Bernay. In spite of the oath which had been sworn at Senlis, none of these places would comply with the Prince of Navarre's orders to surrender, but none of them had resisted for very long. Some of the Navarrese troops were prepared to fight, but by and large, the King of Navarre's Norman subjects were not. Évreux, which had never been a strong place, had already been abandoned by most of its defenders. Its Navarrese captain persuaded his companions to open the gates. At Bernay, the basse-cour of the castle surrendered as soon as the French arrived. The keep was defended by the King of Navarre's secretary, Pierre de Tetre. He knew what fate was in store for him if he fell into the French king's hands, but he could not persuade the garrison to hold out. On April the 19th, after the walls had been battered by trebuchets for 2 days, Bernard de Guisquelin arrived with reinforcements to mount an assault. The defenders sent Pierre out to parley and with the French and then pulled up the drawbridge behind him, so he couldn't return. The garrison surrendered later that day. Pierre was arrested and sent to Paris to be delivered to the jailers at the Temple Prison. The constable and the Duke of Burgundy had promised to put a good word in for him, and no doubt did so. But any inclination of Charles V to be merciful was quickly dispelled by the clerks who examined the contents of Pierre's chests in the keep of Bernay. They included much of Charles of Navarre's correspondence with his representatives in France over the past year, its meaning only lightly disguised by a crude code in which the pseudonyms were substituted for proper names. Pierre de Tetre filled the gaps out in the cell of the temple. An even fuller account of his master's secret diplomacy than the earlier revelations of Jacques Leroux. The resistance of the eastern group of Navarrese castles came to an end in the beginning of May 1378. Breteuil surrendered for cash on about the 3rd. Beaumont followed a few days later. The former Navarrese captain of Évreux came before the gate of Passé and persuaded the garrison that further resistance was hopeless. They abandoned their post without striking a blow. In the whole of the Seine Valley, the only place which continued to resist was Pont-d'Omer, then an important river port. Pont-d'Omer was blockaded from the south by garrisoned bastides constructed by Admiral Jean de Vienne from the river by 4 galleys of Monaco. Its Navarrese captain declared that as long as Charles of Navarre was alive, he would surrender only to his personal instructions. But even he was not willing to chance his life for long. At the beginning of June, the French brought up cannon against the walls and increased their strength around the town. The defenders surrendered on the 15th and returned for pardons. 3 months' wages in their pockets and safe conduct to Cherbourg. In the Cantine, the French invasion began in the last week of April 1378. It was conducted by about 1,000 local troops recruited in Lower Normandy. The principal towns of Carton, Valognes, and Auvranches surrendered rapidly. They were all substantial places whose population probably refused to defend them against the royal army. In most cases, the King of Navarre's captains in the citadels were simply bought off. The only resistance came at the smaller places where garrisons were less dependent on the popular support of the towns for their defense. The castle of Gavray, which housed Charles of Navarre's Norman treasury, was defended by a garrison of just 34 men for almost a month. The defenders sold the place at the end of May, only after its powder magazine had blown up and its food stores had been exhausted. By June, only Mortain and Cherbourg held out. for the King of Navarre. Mortain was already under siege and preparations were in hand for an attack on Cherbourg. After four civil wars in a quarter of a century, Charles V had resolved to finish with Charles of Navarre. On June 16, 1378, as the campaign in the Seine Valley was drawing to a close, the king presided at a public session of the Parliament of Paris, attended by the whole of the royal council, many of the leading noblemen of the French court, and representatives of the municipality of Paris, the usual chorus summoned to witness the great occasions of the French state. The notarized confession of Jacques Déroux and Pierre de Tetre were read out to the assembly gathered. Copies were distributed amongst the crowd outside. The two men were brought in to acknowledge the truth of their contents. They were then condemned to be beheaded in the market of Les Halles, and their dismembered bodies exhibited in the four principal gates of Paris. As the King of Navarre's ministers were taken to the scaffold, the last Navarrese garrison to hold out against France, the French onslaught, was coming to the end of its resistance. The defenders of Mortain sued for terms after artillery had been brought up and sappers had undermined the walls and towers. Of the 21 fortresses seized by the royal fortresses, 14 were wholly or partially demolished over the next 2 months, and royal garrisons were put into the others. Ferrando de Anz, who had proved either unable or unwilling to procure the surrender of a single castle, was locked up in the citadel of Caen and then in Rouen Castle, where he appears to have passed the rest of his days. So the French got in the action pretty quickly, and Charles of Navarre is doomed. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption.